Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. This is Kelly Barner, editor of Buyer's Meeting Point. Today, I would like to welcome Alan Braithwaite as my guest. Alan is a visiting professor at Cranfield University and specializes in supply chain strategy and operational excellence in the retail, manufacturing, and service sectors. He is chairman at LCP Consulting, which collaborates with over 400 companies internationally. In 2015, Alan co-authored Business Operations Models, Becoming a Disruptive Competitor with Martin Christopher, who you might know is one of the authors of two other well-known procurement titles, Leading Procurement Strategy and Humanitarian Logistics. Alan joins us today to talk a little bit more about business operations models and how the theory applies specifically to procurement. Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Hello.
So let me have you start off, just for the sake of anyone that's joining us but who has not already read your book. Can you provide a high-level overview or sort of the core idea within the book?
Yeah, sure. The big idea and the reason why we wrote it was that we wanted to point to what makes a super-performing business. So how does a business do exceptional things for both its customers and its shareholders and as a result create value for both? And the whole thesis of the book is that this can be achieved through the way companies design and configure and operate their businesses, so operations management. And that this is a seriously under-recognized area of business strategy. And so we've tried to fill that gap, and we've tried to offer executives and academics a framework by which they can think through those opportunities and also with case studies. So that's what we set out to do. I hope it's worked.
Now, it's interesting that you sort of started that off by talking about the big idea. Because one of the things that I was struck by when I read the book is that, in essence, you really kind of sum that big idea up actually on page 2 of the book. And I love this quote that I pulled from it, which says, "The big idea behind this book is that the way a company configures its operations to deliver this brand experience to customers while delivering viable financial performance is an opportunity for significant competitive advantage and marketplace disruption." So when you listen to that quote, I remember thinking at the time, okay, I mean, I completely get on board. It's hard to disagree with the idea that operational structure plus a value-added brand experience and solid financials, of course, will ultimately lead to a competitive advantage. But the whole reason for people to read the rest of the book is that while agreeing with that notion is very easy, executing it is very difficult. Why do you think it is so difficult to get everything to align for companies to actually accomplish this in their operation when most people would firmly get behind the concept?
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, if you say it quickly, it sounds easy. The book was a bit of a journey of discovery as well, because in preparing the case studies, some of the maxims that we then offered came out. You know, it can take years to become an overnight success is one of the ones I love most. And you can just look at that in the time charts that we offered on shareholder value, and you can see that companies bumped along. You know, they had a bit of a surge, but actually weren't doing exceptional things. And then the last brick of the strategy fell into place. Maybe the market turned for them. Maybe they discovered one final element or a couple of final elements, and then the business surged. And of course, the second maxim is that success is ephemeral. It doesn't last forever. Almost no business can maintain its position at the top indefinitely. There are, and curiously, the more prosaic the business is, so the more conventional it is, it's probably easier for those companies to stay in the game and stay ahead of the game and still provide value. You know, shooting stars like Apple, in order to sustain the trajectory and the shareholder perception, you know, their track record of innovation has got to almost be exponential. So this is a tough thing to do. You're absolutely right. Not easy. Lots of pitfalls, but what we tried to do was to introduce this idea of narratives and being able to hopefully help executive teams to think about the narrative of their business in terms of where they are, where they're trying to get to, what those dependencies are, and what the building blocks of value will be in their framework. Because the other thing that I loved and I enjoyed writing about was the idea of the aggregation of marginal gains. And that's a great maxim that came from the British cycling team, who've been very dominant in recent years. And their coach, Sir Dave Brailsford, talks about his success as being the aggregation of marginal gains. And the answer is you only have to be a little bit better than your competitor to win. You don't have to be streets ahead to attract market share or to win the competition. And you can very often do that through very, very careful management of the basics. And we've got some nice case studies in there that try and deal with that and show that example.
Well, and that idea of pulling together marginal gains, I think it speaks to the idea that you're not talking in this book about companies that are lagging their markets or who have fallen behind or are in some kind of trouble, but companies that are already pushing towards excellence, pushing towards that superior performance. And it is shaving off those fractions of additional performance that gives them the opportunity to sort of jettison to the head of the pack. It must have been thrilling for you and for the teams that you've worked with to have the opportunity to work with these teams that were in such a leadership position already. Did the formation of the operations model idea in part come from the fact that you did have access to these exceptional teams?
Well, I'm very old and long in the tooth, as they say now, and we reckon that I've worked with around 400 companies through my career, and that's an exceptional exposure to the number of companies, but also the whole range of issues that they face. And some of those companies are already leaders or at least performing well. Others are, occasionally, we did work for Apple in the 90s, and that was very exciting. And then they had their trough from 94 onwards, and that was when we were let go. But the whole trajectory of companies doesn't really matter whether they're a laggard, so they're not performing well, or whether they're already well into the top 50% or even the top quartile. And that the principles still apply. Clearly, if you've got a business that's going backwards, there's a different sense of urgency, because the biggest single risk is the cash runs out. And if you run out of cash, you don't have a business, and people will come and prey on you. So the principles apply, but the application of those principles will vary depending on where the business is in its pathway.
Now, when you talk about defending that cash position, that actually speaks directly to what the majority of my audience is concerned about, because most of them are in procurement and supply chain. And yep. Reading the book from that perspective, I actually have to thank you for one of the positions that you've taken in the book, which is that sourcing and supply management should not be just about functional optimization, but that we can, in fact, make contributions to operational excellence. It's something that people in procurement have been fighting to convince people of for a long time. In those 400 companies, can you share an example or two of where you saw a procurement or a supply chain operation make a significant contribution to the effort that was being mounted?
Well, it's a really good point, and I could talk for half an hour on the role of procurement. Just step back a moment. I see procurement as having three separate and quite distinct organizational roles and responsibilities. And the first is transactional, which is just to make sure that you buy things when you need them, you buy the right things, you pay for them, you don't get overcharged, and you don't get undersupplied. So that's a sort of transactional role. The second is setting up what I would describe as conventional purchasing tenders and so on, where you're working on business as usual and you're trying to optimize the business, and that's obviously a core role for purchasing and procurement. And then the third is contributing to the strategy of the business by really working on the innovation opportunities in terms of how you buy, what you buy, how the whole thing fits together in the business model. And obviously that can be then what you do internally as opposed to what you do externally. But it's rather more than that, because you may then bundle capabilities together. And in the book, I dealt with the idea of service dominant logic, which comes from two academics, Vargo and Lush. And their whole thesis, again, is that business transformation can be about complete change in the business model. And I see procurement as being central to that, but I see those three roles as culturally and organizationally not sitting easily together. So I actually argue against procurement sitting at the board table and representing those different roles, because it's almost impossible to wear three hats simultaneously. So if you then go on to examples where procurement has made a dramatic difference, there was a retailer that we worked with that when we started, their profits were going backwards, and their profits are now between two and three times what they were when we worked with them. And there, the buying director, who's also responsible for inventory and merchandise, got a better picture of where his procurement decisions or their procurement decisions were eroding net margin, and then completely reconfigured their supply base and had a totally different conversation with their key suppliers. So they dropped quite a few suppliers. They reconfigured their procurement plans. They rebalanced their inventory. And they drove quite a lot of money out of the initial procurement decision, but they did it by then not giving their suppliers really, really expensive orders to fulfill at an artificially low contract price. So they understood what the balance of the business was. And that's something you see quite often. And then there are some really good examples of a more pure service dominant logic idea where, you know, Rolls-Royce engines and now Pratt & Whitney and GE, they all provide power by the hour to the airlines. So they take the entire responsibility for financing, for servicing, for the readiness time and the availability, and they charge the airlines against a service agreement just for putting oomph into the wing of a plane. And of course, the initial procurement executives that set that up would have had to do a very delicate task and process with their corresponding engine suppliers, because it's a completely new game. And you're now seeing that in maintenance of warships. You're seeing it in the supply of tools and equipment to construction sites. So this is something that is beginning to really impact. And of course, there's nothing in the future arrangement that has any relationship to the way that you used to do it. So it's a huge challenge for procurement to actually then think outside that box. Does that make any sense?
It absolutely does. And one of the things that I was thinking about when you were sort of discussing initially those three hats worn by procurement around managing the transactions, controlling the cost, but also contributing to innovation and what the organization is capable of as a whole, it reminded me of one of the earlier points you made around companies needing to create value for both customers and for shareholders. And I'm certain that at times that actually creates something of a conflict, that to create value for one party would in a way rob value from the other. And this is another one of the ideas from the book that struck me, was that you had talked about the idea that any effort to lower costs has to be done without damaging customer value, just to get a short-term boost in terms of how competitive you are. So even though you're talking about aggregating these smaller gains or smaller improvements, you're not playing a short-term game. You're still playing with a long-term vision. Does that tension between the customer value and the shareholder value, does that come into play in some of the decision-making around these operations models?
Without question, the businesses that succeed in breaking out never lose sight of that vision, even if they're finding life tricky. So they may have to take short-term decisions, if you follow me. The short-termism is prevalent when you're publishing quarterly results. It's something the CEO worries about, but somehow or other, he or she has to then hold the longer term vision in there and have their board discuss those very fine balances. And of course, if you've got very heavily goaled and targeted people, say in procurement, but everywhere else as well, they may do things, meet their short-term targets, which actually, if the CEO fully understood the implications, they might then regret. And he might then regret. So there's a really finely balanced act. And that's why you see companies changing their management teams, because in the end, the chair is far enough removed, hopefully, the non-executives are far enough removed that they can say at the end, is this working? So that the role of those non-executives as part of the governance structure is absolutely crucial. Having a shared vision and knowing what the trajectory of the business is, that's a great skill.
Now, when you talk about that trajectory and the vision and the long-term view that you need to maintain while still undoubtedly executing on a shorter time frame type basis.
Yep.
Does that connect back to what you were discussing about the importance of the narrative? So in this book, you make your point up front very clearly, and then the majority of the rest of the book is spent adding to that, adding detail, of course, but illustrating. And I think it's in that illustration that the message really becomes not only powerful and remains in people's minds, but also becomes very real, because you see that this is not an academic concept. There are all these narratives from other companies that you can learn from, recognize elements in your own business from. To what extent do executives need to be able to learn from the narratives of other companies versus having the vision and the foresight to articulate their own narrative, regardless of where on that journey they happen to be?
Thank you for the compliment. It is bred of, as I said, 30 plus years of experience working with all these different businesses, and there are some businesses here that are represented in case studies that have been deeply embedded in at different times. The discovery is that if you sat a group of executives in a room from the same organization, they would not necessarily be consistently internalizing what's going on to them as a group and for their organization. So even when you've rehearsed the narrative, there are biases. There are, and I remember when I did my MBA many, many years ago at the London Business School, and there was a professor there that had done some very interesting research on strategy, where he'd looked at the performance of an organization and he then correlated that with the consistency of the vision and internalization of the mission of the business. And he found that there was a very, very strong correlation. So it'll never be perfect, but the role of the CEO has got to be to build that narrative, to ensure the consistency, to coach and develop and really bring the team together. It's not a one-man thing, this. It requires the team to function, and the CEO's role is in my opinion, is painting that picture, communicating with the senior group, but the whole of the business as well, and making sure that there is consistency, and then basically monitoring the performance against the trajectory, and doing the necessary interpretation. That's how I see a CEO's role. Well, not everybody will agree with me on that, but that's how I see it.
Now, to that point, and feel free to disagree with me about this if you see otherwise, but I read the book as being most obviously directed at a very senior executive level audience. But I think that there's probably also value, both from a sort of an evolutionary perspective, having people move up in the organization and have this sort of thing already in their mindset. Given that it's probably an easier sell to high-level execs, would you make the case, and if you would, what would you say, that either practitioner-level professionals or middle management-level professionals also benefit from bringing this sort of information into their perspective and into their decision-making?
I think that if you're a practitioner or a middle-level executive or even a relatively junior person, understanding the nature of the water in which you're swimming and having as many frames of reference as you possibly can helps you to interpret what's going on and helps you to become ready for the more senior role. So I think, I mean, the feedback I've had, not just from senior executives and academics, but from less senior people, including the people that work in our business, has been fantastic. They've found it accessible, which I'm pleased about, because it's tough to write these things. But they've also said, wow, you know, well, I learned something there, and I can carry that with me. And so those little nuggets that they carry with them that may help them to move on to their next role, but also help them to interpret and understand what's going on.
Now, even extending beyond the content of what's in the book, you recently wrote a post that's on the Kogan Page site, and I'll make sure there's a link to that on today's episode page for anyone who's interested. But you talk about directly sort of what's in the subtitle of your book, which is about becoming a disruptive competitor. And you say in this post that, in fact, becoming a disruptor is all about context. Can you expand on that point a little bit?
Yeah. This linked back to some, because you know I'm a visiting professor at Cranfield. I'm a very curious person because I've straddled the academic and the business world now for 30 years, and that's been part of my narrative, I suppose, is that I've been able to do that. We did some work with a student at Cranfield a few years ago now, and the young man's joined us since. And we tried to look at companies that had done very well, and we tried to interpret what the context was for them. And very much the same as the business operations model framework, where the discovery is that the company will have mastered uniquely for themselves 2, 3, 4 of the facets, but not usually all of them. What we found with the context was that, from memory, I think there were 8 contexts, and you'd typically find 3 or 4 there in what had then driven the behavior of the executive team and how they reached their decisions. You know, part of it's a burning platform, obviously, but not exclusively. And one of the cases I tell in the book is the John Lewis department store business here in the UK. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they're Britain's most loved business. Everybody loves John Lewis, and they've done unbelievably well in the last 8-10 years. Just fantastic. And we've been very lucky. We've been able to work with them and make a small contribution to that. But the big insight was that they discovered that their business model at very granular levels was not scalable to what their ambition was. And so they started to look around for different ways of doing things that would be both cheaper and better for the customer and their staff, because they're an employee-owned business, so they don't have shareholders in the routine way. Their employees are their shareholders. That was, for them, an extraordinary journey, because some of the things started to emerge were very counter to the culture of the business and the way the business had always done business. And so they had a very long journey to get to a place where they wanted to be, but they discovered, and this is the idea of serendipity, when they got there, they discovered that actually they'd done some things which were scalable. They were able to embrace a market that was changing, so the growth in e-commerce in the UK is remarkable. they were able to fulfill that demand very, very cost effectively. And they turned their e-commerce business from £200 million to £1.5 billion in, I think it was about 7 years. That's a huge growth, unbelievable growth. But what they then discovered was there were a whole range of spin-off benefits that nobody had anticipated at all. So one of the big maxims in the book is never underestimate serendipity, never underestimate the value of the unexpected. But of course, if you're going to leverage that, you've had to put yourself into a position where you're doing something different in order to be able to take advantage of the opportunities once you see them more clearly. So it's context is everything. And the narrative for another business in a different marketplace with a different dynamic and a different set of capabilities would have been different. You know, and that's the way it is. So, yes, context is everything. I think I just repeated myself, but apologize for that.
No, and I think you make an important point about another one of these things that seems strikingly obvious but is incredibly hard for people to do, and that is to be open to recognize the serendipity and be open to the value of it. You know, I think in some cases it's easy to get blinders on, and companies are in fact being presented with serendipitous opportunities that they just simply don't see because it's not what they're looking for. And so it must be a very hard combination to have sort of the vision and the drive to lay this path where you're willing to take on meaningful change, but at the same time allow a feedback cycle to come back to you to in fact see some of the things that you weren't looking for.
Yeah, and going back into my early career before I moved into consultancy and academia, and again it's in the book, I tell the story of a company called Christy Tyler that I actually worked for. And I worked for the chairman of that business. He's a wonderful man, extraordinary man. I'm just seeing if I can find the page, but I can't quickly. He disrupted the whole of the UK furniture market in the 70s, and went from a market share of I found it here, it's on page 219, went from a market share of less than 5% to a market share of 30% in the space of 7 years. That is astonishing.
That's incredible.
It came through a very curious set of events where they'd had to lay off a lot of staff because the market was very volatile and they were losing money. Then the market came back at them very quickly. And so he set up this sort of cell, you may have heard of cell manufacturing, in one of his barns on his private estate. And bought in the materials, and within 3 weeks, this cell that had used to work for the business, he'd laid them off, they were producing at roughly twice the output of the existing factories. And he was able to recognize that, and he simply re-engineered all of that working method back into the plants. And they were selling upholstered furniture, which was astonishing value for money, and they went and grew this huge market share, and that's actually that's the Walmart story. You give customers amazing value, they'll shop with you, they'll buy from you, if you're efficient enough to do that, you can cut your margin in order to get more volume. If you cut your margin to get more volume, you'll grow your business because your prices are competitive and you'll return to shareholders. So this quite small UK business literally disrupted its entire market, and lots of the competitors just went bust. They couldn't cope with it. They couldn't deal with it. But in the end, it was George. George saw the opportunity and grabbed it with both hands. So he's a great leader, and you need these great leaders.
Now, if you take a look, and you've mentioned that you've had an amazing opportunity to work with a large number of companies over a number of decades where things have changed considerably in the business world. One of the things that I always worry about when you get into a discussion of transformation or what's new is that without realizing it, at any given point in time, we think we're doing something very new, but in fact, it's just sort of an old trend come up again that has been renamed or repackaged or has a glossy new process chart. And we don't recognize it as being something that was tried before and had some amount of effectiveness, but then went out of popularity, and now it happens to be coming back in. If you look back over the experiences that you've had, what are the couple of forces that you would say truly were transformational in the sense of how businesses operate and what really did affect lasting change versus the things that were just sort of like passing fads that didn't really stick?
The really big advances have been in technology. And in the book, I talk about the technology dimension of being a disruptor. And I try to argue that it's not the technology that disrupts, it's how you apply it. So in operations management, time compression, doing things faster, doing them in smaller batch sizes, doing them more in response to customers' demands, but still doing them cheaper, is a sort of recurring theme. And the technology changes that have happened in my lifetime, I mean, I was thinking the other day about my dear old dad who passed away in 1981, and some of the stuff that we're doing now, I'm sure he wouldn't have been able to believe, because you got your handhelds and your apps and all the rest of it. But actually, what are they doing? They're just taking time and labor and process out of the system so that you can be more customized, you can be more granular, you can be more precise, and you can do it faster and better and cheaper. And so those messages haven't changed, but the technology has enabled them in a whole range of ways, which, as I said, 30, 40 years ago, you just wouldn't have dreamt of.
So as we begin to sort of wrap up here, one of the questions that I always like to ask about, especially with authors, is what's next? I think it's easy for people to forget just how much time passes between when you've completed writing a book and then it becomes available for purchase and then it sort of enters the professional conversation. So you've had a lot of time since this content in business operations models was locked down to continue experiencing new things and making plans going forward. So is there anything that you want to share about your work, either in business or in academia, or maybe even a tip on a new book that you could share about what is next on the horizon for you in terms of your work?
I'd never written a book. My co-author had. I carried the majority of the workload on this one, but it was a pleasure to collaborate with him. And I have to say that I sort of collapsed in a heap when it came out in May last year, because it was a huge effort. So I took a bit of a breather, but and somebody wrote to me the other day and said, you know, are you going to have another edition? And I thought, well, I'm not quite ready for that. The thing I am interested in very specifically is the societal implications of supply chains, particularly in relation to logistics and the environment. And so I've been working on, and I'm still working on, the idea of new models for urban logistics, new models for internet fulfillment, new models for transport infrastructure, and that's an area that fascinates me. And again, looking forward, the way we do things today is not sustainable in the future. Looking forward, there'll be a whole range of opportunities that will come from technology, but we're also going to need new operating models in order to leverage that technology. So that's the area that interests me at the moment. And given my age, that will probably see me out. I should be working on that for the next 2 or 3 years. Hopefully I'll see some major changes follow through behind that.
And in 2 or 3 years from now, which hopefully does not reduce you back to that heap, we will be glad to read a book on all of those implications of changes in the supply chain and the larger sort of environment that it ends up being a part of. So for anyone that is interested in reading Business Operation Models, Becoming a Disruptive Competitor by Alan Braithwaite and Martin Christopher, I will make sure that there is a link to more information about the book on today's Blog Talk Radio episode page, as well as some of Alan's additional writing, which has appeared on Kogan page. Alan, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, it's a pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
And thank you as well to everyone who has joined us for this BMP Radio podcast. Please feel free to share your comments and feedback on this conversation, as well as to share it with anyone else from your network that you feel would benefit from the information. Thank you for joining us.